Good evening again. My name is Michael Castro. I'd like you to welcome you to River Styx at Duff's. Tonight's River Styx at Duff's features three artists returning to St. Louis, where in recent years they have lived and done some of their best creative work. It's a homecoming for the fiction writers Lee K. Abbott and John Connolly, and for the composer Joe Catalano, and we're happy it's happening and that we're part of it and that you're part of it. Tonight's event is also special in that through it we want to recognize and applaud the work of the small independent press in America in general, and its traditional and ongoing efforts in nurturing and sustaining a literature in this country. And in particular, tonight we want to honor one of those presses, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, the publisher of John Connolly and Lee K. Abbott, among other fine writers. In 1982, this press started, as so many presses have, with a dream of its founders, Shannon Ravenel and Louis Rubin. They decided to start a press dedicated to publishing, of all things, good writing, as simple as that. They had access to good writers through the teaching and other literary work they were involved in, and they'd seen many writers struggle in search of a publisher that was never found. And they thought they could do something to help at least some of them. They also decided to do it right in the sense of not limiting them to being a local or regional press, to be national in their scope of concerns, and to compete directly with the large commercial publishing houses, both for writers and distribution of books. Well, it's 5 years, and by my count in the 87 calendar, about 54 books later, and they are still at it and going stronger each year. Several of the authors associated with Algonquin Books have achieved commercial successes in the sense of numerous printings, selling reprints of books to mass market distributors and even films. Consistently in the line of fiction, which is only one of the lines they've published, their writers have gotten excellent reviews and notices. One of the major reasons for that is one half of the publishing editing team, a woman who's with us here tonight and works out of her office in her home in St. Louis, Shannon Ravenel. And we'd like to recognize Shannon here tonight because this is her night as well as that of the writers. When you look into the work of Algonquin Books and you talk to people or you read about it, what you come upon is testimony after testimony by writers and other people in the literary world to the incredible skill and dedication of Shannon Ravenel as a literary editor. Louis Rubin himself says there's no one better at doing the patient, detailed editing that can mean the difference between a fully realized work of fiction and a mediocre one. And I think that the writers here today probably each have their own stories about the interaction of their work with the mind and judgment of Shannon Ravenel. So I'd like to ask Shannon to come up here and for you to show your appreciation and ask her to introduce the first reader tonight, John Connolly. Shannon Ravenel.
Thank you, Michael. All of us at Algonquin Books are very grateful to Michael Castro and to the River Styx and to Karen Duffy and Duffs for arranging this very nice program tonight. I am at that strange stage in life called middle age when everybody else's age becomes intensely interesting. And maybe it's for that reason that the first thing I think of when I think of introducing John Conley is that he's very young. He's only been 28 for 3 days now. The second thing about him that you should know is that although he's an Algonquin author and writer, he is not a Southerner. And I think he would like you to know that. John, like his characters, his young characters, they're in their 20s looking at 30, I note, is a Northeasterner. He was born and raised in Norwood, Massachusetts, which is outside of Boston, and he studied for his undergraduate degree at Boston University. The first I knew of John's work was in 1982, I think, when Stanley Elkin gave me a manuscript of his to read. The manuscript was of John's story, Teamwork. I read it, and it knocked the breath right out of me. As John Lahr has said of John Conley, here is a writer at the beginning of his career who is more poised and trenchant than many American writers at the end of theirs. It looks as if, and this is the publisher speaking and the lady who put the money out to get the book published, it looks as if the rest of the world is going to recognize John Conley. The rest of the literary world is beginning to recognize this really remarkable talent. The early reviews, the things that we call pre-publication reviews, are uniformly excellent. Those have been in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Publishers Weekly, and something that we all depend on greatly called the Virginia Kirkus Reviews, which I doubt many of you have heard of. The Virginia Kirkus Reviews is a bookseller's service that provides pre-publication reviews that bookstore owners use when they're trying to decide what books to buy for their store. The review service is infamous for being brutal and very critical, and I'd like you to hear what it has to say about John Conley's first book. 10 stories that are uniformly compelling in their accretion of homely details. Conley's mastery of pace and detail is impeccable, and a theme slowly emerges of hinted mental imbalance, usually in the working class, or just above, lives of the male characters. The world these characters live in may be unresilient, static, and depressed, but it is limned, as in, say, the early stories of Richard Yates, with a concision and completeness that makes them hover before the eye. Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill is very proud to be the publishers of John Conley's first book of stories, Man's Work. And I'm very proud to introduce the author, John Conley. Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon. And thank you all for being here. It is a thrill, and that's an understatement, to be back in St. Louis. I came here, as has been said, 5 years ago, and I left 2 years ago, and I am now no longer quite sure why I did. The story I'd like to read to you tonight has been spoken about briefly before tonight, called Teamwork. It's the first story I wrote in St. Louis after my wife and I had moved from Morgantown, West Virginia, and arrived on a July afternoon in St. Louis in 1982. This story is set, like most of my work, in southern New England, but St. Louisans will recognize the weather because the weather is St. Louis weather moved to New England, as happens maybe a day or two every year. So it's on that particular day that this story takes place. Just a couple of perfunctory notes. This is a fairly long story. I expect it'll take me about 40 minutes to read. It's about a family of women, a mother and six daughters. And although the mother would object, I would recommend that you ignore virtually three of her daughters in the middle and concentrate on the oldest daughter, whose name is Janet, the youngest daughter, whose name is Ellen, and the next to youngest daughter, whose name is Chris. The others are important as well, but six is a lot of balls to keep in the air, I know, without the text. Teamwork. Mrs. Fair lives with her six daughters. Janet is 22, Andrea is 19, Donna is 18, Jill is 17, Chris is 16, and Ellen is 15. Experts say don't dote on your kids, and she doesn't really, but she will take the time to rattle off names and ages like that and add some data on each, because she wants them to exist for everyone as individuals, which they are, rather than as just her kids. She calls from work just once a day, more from habit than from worry. Mrs. Fair is a secretary at a clinic where it is always a dull kind of busy. This morning she calls an hour before lunch, and Andrea tells her that Lou is on the side steps waiting for Ellen to get home from summer school. Ellen had refused to sign up, but Mrs. Fair got help from her two oldest daughters and forced Ellen's agreement. That nasty, strict scene last April was exceptional for Mrs. Fair, who in this advanced age usually lets things slide, but none of her daughters has ever stayed back, and the school's counseling specialists say promotion denials as late as 10th grade are threatened only in extremes like this, so Mrs. Fair is satisfied that she isn't being too severe. She's making it up to her litless one by accepting Ellen's mangy 25-year-old boyfriend without comment, except to Kit McGovern, the doctor's wife, two blocks farther up the hill. Kit agreed about summer school in this case, and she advised flexibility on the boyfriend. Sometimes, Kit McGovern says, they have to run before they can walk. Nighty and humid before noon, extreme for New England, but Lou wears long pants because he may need them. Ellen told him to get her at home right after summer school, and they would go to lunch someplace nice before the Cape. Ellen shouldn't be too much longer, especially if she's getting a ride. Lou knows better than to turn up early, but on his day off, there's little else to do. Facing downhill from his spot below the kitchen window, Lou sees approaching traffic long before it arrives, what little there is. Most shoppers in the plaza below don't use the shortcut through here, and they barely notice the neighborhood. From the parking lot below, this hill is pure background. The Fairs is the smallest house in sight, an odd lot bordered by streets on all sides but the back. A few houses farther up the hill look nice, but most, like the Fairs, don't quite. Lou's head, at least, is in the scarce noontime shade. He reclines against the house's gray shingles, arm's length from the kitchen door. In the Fair's backyard, a manual lawnmower ticks through the shaggy grass. Jill mows in a pattern, a perpetually shrinking square, and as instructed, she walks forward with the mower. She never pulls it back toward her. Mrs. Fair has schooled her daughters in the menace of machines. For protection, Jill wears solid black shoes, nun's shoes. They look silly with her loose tank top and shorts, and Jill is the first to laugh about them. She plows up a small rise and into a corner of the yard. They never use the motorized mower. Ellen tells Lou it's been in the garage for 7 years, gas tank full. Before he died, Mr. Fair once shattered a car window by mowing a rock with it. The screen door opens and Chris steps out in her one-piece bathing suit. After Ellen, Chris is next youngest. A dull, scratchy beach towel, wrapped from waist to calves, has the Pepsi label across it. "You can go in if you want," Chris says as she steps over Lou's feet. "They're having lunch soon. There's nothing to eat now, so somebody goes to the store and buys all sorts of stuff. You're welcome to it." Ellen said something about eating out.
Lou squints up at her more than he has to. Ellen talks about Chris a lot. Chris's retainer can finally come out next week. They have a new woman dentist, an angel. She grants gas and Novocaine both, liberally, on even the slightest of fillings. Mrs. McGovern found her. Before her, the Fairs, Chris especially, suffered under Dr. Carr. Hairy hands and heavy breath, he asked, which one were you now? What grade in school now? How many older sisters? How many younger? Then he revved his brutal machinery. Janet, the oldest girl, lost 6 teeth in an hour under token Novocaine. At the magazine rack, she stabbed him with a pencil. And it infuriated Janet that he couldn't learn their names. But Chris withheld all complaint. Even when her mouth moved freely, Chris came home from Dr. Carr with nothing to say. The brace that straightened her back came off after 4 years, about a month before Ellen met her boyfriend Lou. At Mr. Fair's funeral, the relatives marveled. Chris 9 years older and as much help as Janet, more. Mr. Fair spanked Chris least, even in the last 2 years, the only two little Ellen can remember, always one sister screaming and another recovering. But Lou does not know quite this much, though Ellen may mention it. They talk, they live, in his car, into the night with the radio going, and he follows the music. To Ellen he half listens. Of her family, he knows names and a little more. He can tell them apart without help, but that's all. They're still a group, the sisters. Tall as a tropical bird, Chris walks away up the hill where the McGoverns have a pool. Ellen says they chlorinate to death and they make you wash your feet first in soapy water. Mrs. McGovern invites Mrs. Fair often. Mrs. Fair comes back with books. Together they've done some political work and taken 2 night classes. Each claiming they could never do it alone. Ellen likes Kit McGovern in small doses, she says. Lou watches Chris walk with perfect posture and on her toes, gingerly across hot pavement, cooling her feet in grass wherever she can. Hi again, Mrs. Fair says on her second call. How's everybody? No different, says Andrea. I think the problem with this fan is just the wire. Andrea, please don't monkey with that thing. It won't take much doing, Andrea says. I don't think. Just some black tape. This kitchen's a sauna. Please don't fool with it, Mrs. Ferris says. We'll call somebody qualified. I'm going to come home for lunch. That's what I called to say. Oh, Andrea says, suit yourself. There's absolutely nothing to eat. Oh, Mrs. Ferris says, have you got money? No cars, Andrea says. No cars, Mrs. Ferris says. Heaven forbid anybody walks or rides a bike. I assume that means Janet hasn't turned up yet. Nobody will even get on that bike we have, Andrea says. And Ellen's come and gone already, Mrs. Fair says. Ellen's not back yet, Andrea says. Wutzes is still here. That's the only car, Mom. Lose, Mrs. Fair says. He waits and waits, Andrea says. I don't know what he sees in her. Well, don't go asking him, says Mrs. Fair. He sits and sits, Andrea says. Maybe he knows wiring. Maybe he can monkey with it. Don't stereotype, Andrea, Mrs. Fair says. We'll get the thing to a repairman tomorrow. I'm going to call this afternoon. The Fairs own a cat, a huge orange male, husky and well-scarred, old enough to be named G. Gordon Liddy. Janet named him from current events way back, and nobody much cares for the name anymore, but it's too late to give him another one. Ellen says that as a kitten, he'd dash halfway up a tree trunk, stop, and hold his grip that way for as long as he had the will. Near mealtimes, Liddy is expelled from the cool kitchen linoleum, and most days he waits sullenly by the kitchen door. That space taken, he rests now in the garage's shade, his eyes half open looking at Lou, and his matted fur rising and falling. He's not nearly as cute as he used to be, Ellen says. Lou shifts his weight from the top of his back to a new spot near the middle. He doesn't wear a watch. Twice in the month he's known her, Ellen has turned up absurdly late, both times with a pretty good explanation. He can't imagine that she'll be much longer. He knows for a fact that she's running on 4 hours sleep and has only change in her pocket. She has to be back soon. He can hear just enough low notes from Donna's upstairs radio to recognize Susie and the Banshees. Late last night in the car, Tenderness on the Block came on the radio for the first time in 3 years. Lou relished the news. Warren Zevon was dried out and ready to make another record. Ellen never heard of him. She nearly turned it. When they're parked, she always has a hand on the dial, or, when involved, a foot. It breaks both of them up, the music change right in the middle when she switches stations. At that point, each lyric has implications. Ellen is small-breasted, and she wears the sleeveless white undershirts Lou connects with girls in subtitled movies. They use the front seat always. In every car, save for buckets, it is wider and more comfortable. Sometimes Lou wants to expose the backseat myth, but he knows that 25 is a little old for that kind of explaining. Andrea brings a plastic bag of trash around to the side of the house past the kitchen door. That wasn't Ellen, was it? Lou says politely. I heard the phone. Sorry, Andrea says. Excuse me. At Ellen's suggestion, Lou is growing a beard. He wore one briefly 7 years ago in his first and only semester of college. Crazy as it may be to grow a beard in July, here he is. Lou's fingers probe it as much as Ellen's do. Mostly they wander past the knob at the base of the jaw and farther back because Lou finds that an astonishing place for man to have hair growing wild. Lou hasn't touched a razor in the month since they met. If he tried a trim, he'd do it unevenly and then have to shave the whole thing. And Ellen says she likes this wild style better. What happened between the first and second beards, Lou couldn't say. He walked into Sears one day, began work the next, and spent most of 4 years at the Brockton store in power tools. Before that, 3 years slicing deli in the city at the big grocery in the Prudential. Same thing, he applied on Tuesday and punched the clock Thursday morning. No forethought, no planning. That store had the most frozen food space per square foot of any major store in the country. On Saturday nights, he left the deli counter to ring an extra register for the career girls buying 7 days' worth of Stouffer's and brie. At least the gays cooked. The city girls just boiled water. If they didn't stock up weekly, they were in every night at 6:10, with the corporate up-and-comers delayed until 7 o'clock or later. Most would hardly look at him taking their half pound of sliced Yellsburg, but a few smiled like the shampoo commercials. Yes, an act, but Lou never caught them in it with others working the floor. Maybe that chest-high deli counter gave them their nerve. In his worst moods, Lou wanted to vault the counter and grab them and see if they kept smiling. Home for lunch, Mrs. Fair parks the station wagon in the driveway behind Lou's car. She doesn't step over him at the kitchen door. Instead, she comes around front and passes through the empty living room. Is anybody watching this? Mrs. Fair touches the television. I am, Donna calls from the bathroom. Mrs. Fair hands the car keys to Andrea. Andrea opens the kitchen door, steps over Lou's legs, and asks if there is anything he needs. Lou says there isn't. Jill has finished the lawn. She lifts the old mower over G. Gordon Liddy and then wheels it deep into the garage, which stands separate from the house. Get something good, she calls to Andrea. Jill smiles toward Lou, and with the cat at her heels, she walks inside. Andrea drives away down the hill, flipping the dial away from Mrs. Fair's news radio station. Where's Ellen? Mrs. Fair asks Donna, who's out of the bathroom. School still, Donna shrugs. Jill kicks off her nun's shoes. She pours 3 glasses of tab. Maybe it's an extra long class. I doubt that, Donna says. She looks at Mrs. Fair. She's kept him waiting 30 minutes already. More, Jill says. I'll get those, Mom, Donna says. It's hotter here than it is outside, Jill says. Chris is swimming, asks Mrs. Fair. Right, Jill says. It's too hot to eat, Donna says. It's way past eating weather. Today's the worst yet, Mrs. Fair says. The grass is loud, Jill says. You can tell it's super hot. It's just noisy out there. You'd never know this cat ate 4 hours ago, Mrs. Fair says. Sit down and relax, Mom, Donna says. Toss him out, Mrs. Fair says. She reaches for the mail, which is always placed by the first to spot the mailman in the pantry atop the stack of 8 high school yearbooks, 1975 to 1982. Chris's Sports Illustrated, a letter from their congressman, a bank statement, and that's all. Donna is already into the Psychology Today. In the living room, the television plays to no one. At some point years ago, the family moved into the kitchen. now rarely all together as they might have been in the living room, Sunday nights especially. Mrs. Fair had liked that crowded sight, regressive as that may sound. She cursed the vanished chances for photos of her daughters all together, or in their many other combinations. These combinations, by her careful count, number 61, and the thought of that hidden list makes her feel silly but rich. Without many pictures, Mrs. Fair finds herself envisioning her daughters as a tight package, a kind of ball, with the ends, Ellen and Janet, fraying just a little. In her first year as a widow, Mrs. Fair sat at the kitchen table writing checks one Sunday night when Ellen, she was 7 or 8, came in from the living room and asked if they were poor. Mrs. Fair said no, but Ellen cried anyway. She made herself cereal and would not leave. Mrs. Fair corked over what used to be the kitchen art wall, and with bright plastic pins, she tacked notices of who must sign what and register where to keep up all the brown envelopes with the government checks. It's too bad, but that's how it must be done. The older girls register for community college and then drop out the first week, and they are paid off the books where they work, and the Social Security keeps coming. Except for Janet's crusade to buy herself a new car, they've all been saints, and the family manages. They don't talk about it much. Lou sees Janet's red Celica on the approaching streets for a good minute before it finally pulls in. The car rattles to a stop behind Lou's car. Fresh dents on both sides of Janet's car. On the driver's side, it's the whole door. On the passenger side, the parking light and the sweet curve of metal above the front tire. Janet is furious. She scrambles out from behind the wheel and she flips open the passenger door on her way into the kitchen. Scott, her boyfriend, climbs out slowly. He wanders for a moment, then stands in the cut grass and leans against a rusty clothesline pole. Scott is only 17. He's carrying a camera, which seems out of place on him. Some people don't look right with cameras. Scott looks to Lou like the new stock boy the market hired every 3 weeks, the low man who drew frozen food duty, the one who learned about gloves the first day and then forgot them all the next 3 weeks, who stocked hundreds of viscid, numbing, frozen juices without complaint, and who would rather take a wrong guess than ask you something, but who was not without value, who you were wary of at first, but who might have been interesting, a friend, if after 3 weeks he hadn't vanished and the next one already punched in. But Lou has never seen a stock boy with a nice camera around his neck. "Have I had this car even a month yet?" Janet asks. "We hit a moving car and a parked car at the same time. A fucking Japanese sandwich, sushi, Jesus God." She storms past Mrs. Fair and straight to the telephone. "Fucking how about it from both sides? I can't believe it. Nobody saw anybody. God fucking bless us everyone." But Janet talks sweetly on the phone, and Mrs. Fair walks to the screen door. It is her policy to stay out of earshot of all phone calls, no matter, to provide full freedom for everyone. Donna and Jill are outside circling the wrecked car and avoiding each other's eyes. Both say hello to Scott. Scott mumbles back. Jill is still without shoes. In rhythm, she lifts each foot off the hot cement, then touches it down again. Ellen's boyfriend, Lou, stretches out just below Mrs. Fair. From her angle, Mrs. Fair can see only his corduroy pants. The cat, perturbed, is prowling nothing. For a moment, Mrs. Fair forgets to consider what it is she should do in this situation. But the answer is nothing. She has no duty, so she rests a little and looks outside without really watching. "I talked to my boss," Janet says, off the telephone. "And she knows somebody, really good, supposedly. He can fix it fast." "Nobody was hurt at all?" says Mrs. Fair. "Nope. Excuse me." Janet squeezes by and walks back to the car where she rummages in the glove compartment. Janet's boyfriend has wandered into the garage. He appears amused by the old manual lawnmower, the two-handed saw, the bike with its white wicker basket, the big hedge trimmers. Janet, much calmer now, comes back to the phone. She has had the car for a month and the boyfriend for not much longer. She has 5.5 years on him. On the morning after Janet signed the papers at Toyota, Mrs. Fair arose at 6:20 for work, as usual, and she bumped into Janet coming up the stairs. That was fine. Janet's an adult. But when Mrs. Fair stepped out of an unusually weak shower and when the foggy window cleared, she saw Janet's boyfriend washing the new car, scrubbing and hosing it down, and he was still finishing with a rag when Mrs. Fair silently left the house. Andrea said it was another half hour before he finally walked home. Now Janet is off the phone again and out the door. "Back in a while," she calls to Mrs. Fair, and then the same words, softer, to Scott, her boyfriend, in the garage. But under the words, she's glaring at him. Janet is frequently intolerant. She explodes often and calms quickly, just like her father and just like all of them when they were babies. But more of Mr. Fair, survives in Janet than in any of the others. Mrs. Fair watches her back out carefully, the loose metal of the car scraping over bumps. Lou jerks his shirt from his chest a few times to commiserate with Scott about the heat. Without seeming to notice the connection, Scott threads the front of his own shirt through the camera straps and up to his face. Scott's shirt is short enough for Dixie College football anyway, and now Lou can see that the middle of Scott's firm belly is as lush with hair as the bottom. The clothesline pole has branded a streak of rust down one of Scott's shoulders. His camera hangs ready around his neck. It looks as though Janet and Scott were planning travel, too. Scott looks around and then at Lou again. He steps out of the garage. He groans, and he throws his arms open. "I never saw him coming," Scott says. Scott is Jill's age. In September, they will be seniors. Jill tells Ellen that in China studies this year, Scott looked exhausted. He tried not to fall asleep, but he always did, for about a minute at a time. Janet was wearing him out. Jill tells Ellen that it was pretty funny to watch. For the first time, Lou realizes how tired he is. It's not something he usually notices. He has at least 4 hours driving today, two down to the Cape and two back, once Ellen turns up. She must have a ride or be waiting for one. He should have suggested picking her up at school, though so far she's nixed that idea every time. A warm vertical halo rings Lou's face. He can feel the heat coming off it. A beard does that. Soon now, the first dull electric charge in his stomach. Hunger. A strange thought occurs, one so irrelevant he doesn't think it anymore. He doesn't much want to go. Mr. Fair's younger brother parks on the street. He enters through the front door. He is 34 years old and a captain in the Air Force. He is an angel. Thoughtful, respectful, fair-minded, considerate. Her daughters fuss over him some. They are polite. They don't exactly swarm, but they perk up and show off whenever he visits, which is about once a week. He is always in uniform. He knows about the Social Security, the off-the-books, the college registration. He understands. Mrs. Fair told him about Scott, and he lectured him some. She hasn't mentioned Ellen's boyfriend, Lou. In the living room, before they see her daughters, he hands Mrs. Fair an envelope. Mrs. Fair's brother has money saved up. He spends nothing on himself. Without him, she couldn't have done nearly as much for Chris, the new woman dentist and the orthopedist. The counseling would have been impossible, both for the family as a group and for herself. Her brother has Mrs. Fair's private counseling bill sent to him at the base. Mrs. Fair is grateful for the chance to talk alone with qualified professionals. Even in her less thoughtful years, Mrs. Fair knew that her husband was not exactly the love of her life. She was trained to do all that simple women are trained to do for their men. They met through a cousin when he was 17 and she was 19, and they were married a year to the day later. She sees that their courtship, such as it was typical lower middle class. Married, they did not spend much time together. They got along, but Mr. Fair knew nothing of children or of the most basic psychology, and he refused to learn. During those bleak provincial years, Mrs. Fair really had no clue. Though not happy, she did not feel unhappy either, and of course she probably wasn't unhappy, technically, since she was ignorant of her confinement until near the end. The last year was a trial, and Mr. Fair's house experts were not consulted, and the common sense they spread for free was ignored. It was the Dark Ages. Doctors, yes, but only GPs and a dentist for the kids, no specialists. When his bosses and a few smarter friends began listening to the femme talk, his phrase, from their wives and from books, from talk shows and doctors. He would have none of it. Once Mrs. Fair discovered her dissatisfaction, she was on her own. There was no working with her husband, and things became worse fast. It was truly unbearable after a while. She found coping difficult. Each time she spoke out, he got tougher and more dogmatic. He was taking a belt to the kids when she finally convinced him that violence wasn't the way. Then Janet's new high school friend, Annie, ran from her dreadful parents. Mrs. Fair took Annie in, protected her, and Mr. Fair hit the roof. He was moving out, and they had agreed on separation when he died in an industrial accident that took 3 lives. This was 7 years ago. A belt snapped. Technically, there existed no basis for lawsuit, qualified experts told Mrs. Fair. The company paid his salary through the year, which helped, and they provided for some crisis counseling at the hospital, but it was probably Kit McGovern who most helped Mrs. Fair get through her rage, as Kit insisted on putting it. And at the hospital, Mrs. Fair made the connections that led to her new job. Lou's posture is terrible. His shoulders are sore, and a shingle advances slowly into the back of his neck. But he doesn't move. He is not sure that he could. Scott emerges from behind the garage, still walking, always moving, camera bouncing off his chest. You can go in if you want, Lou says, and it comes out smug. He wonders why he is sounding so much the family insider. For the first time, Scott stands still. He peers into the kitchen. Who's this guy? Their uncle, Lou says right back. That his car? That's mine, Lou says. I thought the Pontiac was yours. I don't know whose that is, Lou says. Across the streets, maybe. Lou points to his own car. That's been here since you pulled in. What's the engine? Scott says. In mine? Lou says. Yeah. I don't know, Lou says. I'm not much on the grease, the vroom vroom. I'm not much on the hard guy stuff. Lou regrets that right away. A peculiar look comes over Scott's face. The jaw tightens and all the other muscles relax. Scott takes a long breath. He sits down on the step very close to Lou. With his head still back against the house, Lou moves only his eyes. He has to look hard to the side, the sort of maneuver that brings a headache before long. Which one are you waiting on? Scott asks. He is beginning to grin. From higher up the hill comes the sound of water, a cannonball with a full running start, a deep, plush, healthy plunge, then the lighter splash across the redwood deck. Ellen, Lou says. There is a pause. Scott does not know them by name. Lou fights a desire to call him on it, wave it in his face. She's at summer school now, Lou explains to Scott. With the short, short hair? Scott smiles again. The little one? Right, Lou says. How long? Scott asks. Have I known her? Right, Scott says. Lou considers. 4 weeks, I guess. I think I've got you, Scott says, but it's close. They are touching from the hip to the knee. Scott plucks some weedy grass from a crack in the cement and he puts a blade between his lips. Been waiting long? Scott says as he grabs Lou's knee. Don't have to say, buddy. It shows. You've been here about all day. Right as rain, you are full out pussy whipped. She's making you suffer, little girl is. She sweats you for it. Scott absolutely beams at him. I know, Scott says. I understand. Too much bed, not enough sleep, as we used to say. Scott stretches his fingers around the meat of Lou's arm. They fuck like a dream, these girls, don't they? Werner Cherry made it through 7th grade, I'm betting. Lou can't seem to move. He wants to motion that they might hear in the kitchen through the screen door. Oh, Scott says. A nice tight fit. Tell me I'm wrong. And delicious. A tasty family, right? You want to eat till you die. You want to suffocate. You want to absolutely swallow every bit. Am I right? Scott squeezes Lou's arm harder. His long fingers reach most of the way around. Lou's neck and all below has gone numb. He can't feel. He could be floating. Now, I'm only 17, Scott says. But I have never, never had my cock sucked like this before, you know? And all the time, and anywhere. They'll do it. They don't care. Oh, sweet Lord. Scott lets go of his arm. You need your rest. He taps his camera. With this, at least, I can get away to across the room. He slaps Lou's leg and gets up. Concentrating, Lou pushes off with his tingling neck and thrusts his rump back flat against the house where it can support weight again. He reaches into his shirt pocket for cigarettes. In a pile of grass cuttings, the cat hunkers down. He sits and sits. He waits and waits. Then he wiggles his back legs like a golfer addressing a tee shot. Then he pounces, and a squirrel darts up a maple. At the base of the tree, Liddy stops and turns back slowly. I'm stranded here all day, I bet, Scott says. He keeps the blade of grass in his mouth. Lou's sleeve is damp from his grip. Scott is a busboy where Janet works. He has huge hands, enormous. Ellen told Lou what Janet told her, that clearing a function room, Scott can carry 7 water glasses in one hand, a glass under every finger with room for 2 more in the middle. In the cocktail lounge, he does 8 with rocks glasses and 9 with highballs. Ellen seemed as fascinated as she said Janet was. Scott has seniority among the busboys. The lady manager, according to Janet, can't get him to keep the top button of his coolie busboy jacket buttoned. Lou thinks his last name might be Kelleher. They watch Andrea climb the hill and pull into the driveway. Before the engine finally dies, she is out of the car and trailing a paper grocery bag in one hand. In one motion, it is swung to her chest. The cat, persistent, climbs out of the grass and falls in behind her. Not back yet, she says to Lou on the stairs. No. Unreal. They're done an hour ago. Is she called? Lou shrugs. I'll tell you if she did or if she does, Andrea says as she steps over Lou's feet. Lou is ready to tell Scott which one that is. But Scott doesn't ask. With both feet, Andrea tries to block Liddy, but she fails, so cat and daughter come stumbling through the door. Getting warmer by the minute, Andrea says, and then to her uncle, howdy. Mrs. Fair's brother perches by the sink and dangles his legs off the formica counter. Sharing, Mrs. Fair thinks, the male preference for any seat that is not a chair. If they'd make a study, Mrs. Fair would read it. Donna walks out of the bathroom. You missed some fun, she says to Andrea, who plants the bag in the center of the kitchen table. Andrea is told about Janet's accident, and there are amazed looks all around. In front of her brother, Mrs. Fair's daughters are as primed yet measured as the great stage actresses. Everything seems very, very lightly contrived. Jill has Liddy half-lifted, wobbling on her bare ankle. Those ears look hideous, she says. Liddy's got an appointment, Andrea says. At Shanga or at Carpenter, Jill says. Shanga, Andrea says. I hate that place, Donna says. She's the least expensive, says Mrs. Fair. It smells even worse than Carpenter's, Donna says. Carpenter closes Monday nights, Andrea says. We have to coordinate these things, Mrs. Fair says to her brother. It takes about 5 of them to get this cat off to the vets. They hide all around with blankets to throw over him. You wouldn't think the place was so big. Liddy sees that little kennel, he just freaks, Jill says. We'll hide it, says their uncle. Yeah, Jill says, but now if there's a blanket out of place, then he smells a rat. Don't you, Gordo? A package of jumbo hot dogs comes out first. They are dumped in water and set to boil. Donna unpacks the relish and a box of popsicles. Andrea pulls out Nature's Organics Plus Jojoba Conditioning Shampoo. A 1/2 gallon of Hood's New Form, 6 frozen burritos, a bottle of Baco Bits, 7 Seas Creamy Italian Dressing, a Charmin 4-pack white. All the provisions, says Mrs. Fair's brother. Andrea the great provider, Jill says. She brings home the Baco Bits. Jill must be content as a voice out of the picture. They all realize that 3 at the table unpacking would look silly. Donna holds a package of 16 light line slices. Andrea takes out the hot dog buns, a 2-liter tab, a bag of Cane's No Salt potato chips, a box of Entenmann's chocolate chip cookies, people, 2 heads of lettuce, a tomato, a cucumber. 99 cents a head, Donna says. Where'd you go? Mrs. Fair asks. Christie's, Andrea says. Andrea? Mom, you're not having to pay for it, Andrea says. You said you only had half an hour. I figured you didn't want me stuck at the supermarket behind some lady's week's shopping. Mrs. Fair stops herself from suggesting that men shop for groceries, too. Jill reaches into the cupboard for the plates. Andy, we have cookies already, she says. Chris baked them last night. She's all over the place lately, Donna says. Happy as a clam, Jill says. That's a stupid expression, Donna says. Who bakes cookies in this weather, Andrea says. Soon the hot dogs boil in the white water. The cat rubs around legs, begging. Now Andrea kicks him gently, pins him between her feet, and after Jill sets everyone's place, she puts him out. Shouldn't we ask those guys in? Jill says. I already did, kind of, says Andrea. With a fork, Jill spears hot dogs and puts them into buns. What do you say to them? Says Donna. Mrs. Fair reaches for a large bowl and a head of lettuce. No more hot dogs for a while after this, all right? She says. They're not doing anybody any good. They look awful, Jill says. Who are these two? Asks Mrs. Fair's brother, looking out the window. Donna points. Janet's, Ellen's. He puts his plate down gently, but it clangs on the rim of the porcelain seats. Sink, excuse me. It is the first he has heard of a boyfriend for little Ellen. Mrs. Fair keeps him seated with a... for just anybody to see. The cat likes it, Jill says. That door's only got a few closes left before it gives, Mom, Donna says. There's nothing anybody would want to steal, Andrea says. Donna laughs. Or could even stand to look at. Unless they're Pennsylvania Dutch, Jill says. Or serfs. They all laugh. Mrs. Fair's brother smiles. No money and no science past the wheel, Jill says. We're crime-proof. We'll just point them up the block, Donna says. Send them up to McGovern's. Have you seen their new shower, Jill asks, putting her food down. The car wash, her daughters are laughing guilelessly for the most part. What is it? Asks her brother. You should get a tour someday, Andrea says. It's a panic. Water comes out of the shower walls in 6 different places, Donna says. Not that many, says Mrs. Fair. From every side, Donna says. It's wild. It's just like a car wash. But you never have to turn, you see, Jill says. That's the beauty. It cuts down on mishaps. And it's so progressive, Andrea says. So extremely today. Easy, says Mrs. Fair. Jill says, and it doesn't violate the rights of women for which we've all been struggling. Her daughters laugh. Mrs. Fair looks at Jill, who doesn't see. In another moment, Mrs. Fair will have to leave only halfway through her salad. Her brother wants a word privately, and her daughters hear this and make small faces at each other. In the living room, he says he can't believe what his sister lets Ellen do. Mrs. Fair says she's late. She'll call tonight. Promise. Just don't do anything. Her brother kisses her and walks back to the kitchen. As always, Mrs. Fair glances into the hall's curved mirror while she goes to the front door. The image is distorted, but she can see Jill going down to the cellar, can hear Andrea calling, "Take out my uniform, please." Can see Donna salting the no-salt potato chips. Her brother is back on the Formica counter drinking milk from the carton. The sweat climbs Scott's hair as up a rope, slowly. The curled ends flattened against his neck. While the heat darkens his hair at the bottom, higher up, the sun turns it lighter. Murder, Lou says, tugging his shirt again. Not so bad, buddy, Scott says. Try Texas sometime. That where you're from, Lou says. Scott raises his bicep to his forehead to wipe sweat. We were there 3 years. It is hell. My town, it wasn't just linebackers shaved their heads. Bunch of us did. Arms and legs, too. An insect paradise, truly. They vacation there. They come for the humidity. They bust down from Tulsa for the weekend. They hear laughter from the kitchen. Scott walks right up to the screen door and looks in for a minute. It's 1:10, he says to Lou. Then he prowls the grounds again. In a few minutes, he's back. They keep it up good here, Scott says. No surprise, I suppose. He sits differently this time, far across the cement step, elbows on knees and hands dangling in. He looks over the streets leading down the hill. He has placed his camera beside him. He's no enemy, Lou knows. You need to take charge, Scott says. She'll use this. It's a weapon now, Scott's famous car wreck. It's like being married. More than a month and you're married. We can't even agree on what movie now. Scott feeds himself another blade of grass. I'm stranded here all day, betcha. That car's out of business for a while, no matter who she knows. My walk home is 55 minutes. I went and did it a while back at 7 in the morning. Maybe I can catch a ride when you're ready. Maybe, Lou says. Whenever that is, Scott says. Whenever you stop waiting. Lou is thinking of Ellen. It was the same with her, like with Sears or the supermarket. You just began, off the street, thrilled that someone not selling anything actually said yes to you, without strings. $2.90 an hour or not, 15 years old or not, you gratefully began. In no time you were an old-timer, an original. You bitched and maybe threatened, but you never gave your notice. You talked about butchers and cashiers and singers on the radio that nobody else remembered. Their names came right back to you. One of the veterans, trusted, in charge of closing meat and deli with a crew of three, but still doing the dirty work yourself to get finished faster, cleaning the deli slicer yourself, the shortcut way, the risky way, running a sponge over it at full speed, pressing the spinning blade firmly, making the wet brown film, the quick way to do it, watching your rolled-up sleeves carefully, keeping them clear of the wheel, picking the thickest sponge you could find, or if the coast was clear, pulling a new pack of sponges down from the shelf, checking yourself a dozen times a second, and running it until the thing was clean enough, close enough. They met at an outdoor party in Walpole in June. That was all he could say. In bed, Ellen was solemn at first. Now she is active, but still solemn, and still says thank you at the strangest times. It should be my car, Scott says. This is ridiculous. I should have the car. You got it right, buddy. A younger one. You need somebody younger. That leaves you only Ellen and Chris in this family, Lou hears himself say. I used to force it into every conversation, Scott says. A girlfriend 6 years older. 17 and 23. I was a big man for a while. But you have to be in charge. Scott wraps the camera strap around one huge finger. The fucking is like the arms race, up and up and up, and you can't de-escalate. It's like taking a test. He looks straight at Lou. His face is pink from the heat. Tell me if I'm crazy. Really, I want your opinion. When you were little, were you sure you'd marry a younger girl? I mean as sure of that as anything. My dad was older, and that was that. They had friends, you couldn't tell to look. The lady was something like 39 and the man 36. But to me, it was like she married a midget. Now, am I the only one? Will you believe me, Lou says. Scott is looking straight at him. I know exactly what you're talking about, Lou says. To the word, you're reading my mind. You could not have said it any better. In the clinic parking lot, Mrs. Fair idles and waits for the man to vacate the parking space while he waits for her. She hits the horn. Her brother might leave the house quietly, but tonight he'll be demanding Ellen's boyfriend's address. She's going to have to tangle with her brother about Ellen's rights. And she can't call him tonight. Dumb. That was why she came home for lunch. She'd be late tonight. The Pierces were giving dinner for friends of Betty's campaign. She beeps again. She's in this guy's blind spot. He's got to be all blind spot. So she reverses a few feet. As best she can while sitting down, Mrs. Fair makes a sweeping after you gesture to the old fool in the Buick Regal. As the front door is pushed open by less experienced hands, the cat darts from his place near Lou and Scott. He tears around the corner of the house and inside to be fed, finally, from a can. The Air Force uncle comes outside into view. He carries his hat and an envelope. He opens his car door slowly and lowers himself in at straight angles. From the other side, they hear a high yell. Chris Ray waves with one hand, slips through the crack in the hedge, and runs past them to the car. The other hand holds her Pepsi towel around her waist. She makes gentle, straight-legged leaps over the oil spots in the driveway. Shards of cut grass flash on the bottom of her feet. She's still wet. Her straight hair has waves and curls. Look, says Scott. She leans far forward, trying to keep her feet on grass and still reach her elbows to the driver's side window. It is too far, and while Chris talks to the Air Force uncle, she steps delicately onto hot pavement. She puts one foot down at a time and cools the other against her calf. It is weirdly wholesome. The soldier takes leave, and the young girl says breathless goodbye. The Air Force uncle can't see them for Chris's face, and they can't see him for her back. She drops the towel and stands on it for relief, wiggling her toes in it. A one-piece paisley bathing suit, not shabby or torn, but still a relic. Lou has been at least 2 hours here outside this women's house, sweating and waiting. Lou and Scott both look at the car and at the girl. They don't speak. Lou has no questions, though he can't yet name what he knows. That something here needs fixing, maybe. He knows he's not waiting anymore. Chris's legs are thin and straight and bruised delicately, inconsequentially, the small bruises that fade in a week. Scott snaps a picture. She leans at a hard angle, elbows out and back straight, feet tight together as if a doctor were checking posture. The Air Force uncle's engine starts and he drives away. We'll go now, Lou says. Teamwork. With teamwork, anything's can do. It's all possible. Alone and wheeling produce or power tools through a crowded aisle, you felt silly and demeaned, the grunt work. But in tandem, there's a world of difference. Coming through, you have right on your side. You want to be noticed. The crew, coming through, please. When the military man finally pulls away, Scott moves first and Lou lifts himself to follow, or rather to join. It is odd to be walking again. At first, Chris smiles, turning to see them. Scott's huge hands settle gently on her shoulders. She comes along soundlessly. She sits between them on the front seat. Lou doesn't notice right away, but his face fills both his mirrors. He had turned them on himself hours ago, sitting parked at the Fair's house in his first moments of confinement. Lou starts his car. He doesn't know what he's doing, but then he never does. He just walks in off the street and begins. He tells himself it will be nothing to regret. When he sees the mirrors, they are full of the face in his wallet, on all his ID. Squinty, frozen, maybe dormant, maybe unprepared, now with a beard. The girl sits between them, and she wears a cautious smile. She has nothing to say. It takes a full minute, but at last they are downhill and out of sight of the house.
Thank you.